Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar, and my guest is Larry Olmsted. His book is called Real Food, Fake Food. And one of the chapters in his books, he quotes the Royal Society of Chemistry. And this is what it means to us listening. One of the greatest problems facing this branch of criminal investigation, food forensics, is what he's calling it, is that consumers can't always tell when they're being defrauded. And this estimates the cost to the global food industry at $49 billion. Larry, what do you mean by that? Or what does the Royal Society of Chemistry mean by that?
We also, they're in the UK. We also have an organization here in the US at the Michigan State University called the Food Fraud Initiative. They did a similar study and they came up with 50 billion versus 49 million. So that's probably a pretty accurate number because they were so close. And that's the basically the cost to the consumers of what you're overpaying for food that is either adulterated or mislabeled, and mislabeled would be, when you pay, as I mentioned earlier, say for red snapper and you get tilapia, you're way overpaying for the value. And adulterated would be when you buy, what you think is honey, but it's been cut with corn syrup, so you're getting a cheaper product.
What about the bottled water industry? Is there any regulation on that? And what's the difference between drinking water and purified water and table water?
That is not something I cover in the book. It is regulated, but they have to meet the standards for safe drinking water. That they measure the quantity of lead and heavy metals and other things in the water. The issue gets a lot of press because a lot of the big producers basically are using tap water, which in most of the country is completely safe to drink, but they're just filling bottle. People have this image of because originally most bottled water came from streams or from a source, a natural source, and some people prefer, like if you drink some of the French water. It typically Evian. It comes from a spring in France, a particular place. You can go to the town of Evian, and that's where the water comes from. And it's sort of known for that. But a lot of the bottled water we drink today just comes from the tap, and so you're paying, $1 a bottle for something that's essentially free. That's the bigger problem, but it's not really a rip off. You're paying for water, you're getting water. So to me, for my purposes in my book, Real Food, Fake Food, I define fake food as any time you get something other than what you think you're buying. And I think when you buy water, you expect to get water, and you get water.
So the point is, other than it being we're the fact that we're overpaying for food that is not what it says it is, but also that we need to have higher regulations. And how do you suggest that we do something like that, where we can actually get our government to comply with the whole fake food industry and make higher standards?
Well, I mean, I think it does need better regulation, but maybe even more importantly is it needs more enforcement of the existing regulations. So, a lot of these things, I mentioned, the analogy of somebody selling counterfeit bags on the street. A lot of these things already are illegal or there's rules against it. It's just either not being enforced or there's not enough resources devoted to it. So, seafood fraud has widely been known. It's a long-term problem. It's a big problem. And in 2014, President Obama appointed a federal task force specifically to combat seafood fraud. And that gives you an idea how big the issue is. It's not like you hear about the president, convening a task force to fight milk fraud. So, and their recommendations and practices are just starting to take effect now, and already, they're resulting in stepped up FDA investigations of seafood, and hopefully there's going to be some other progress coming down the road. Likewise, in April of this year, Congress ordered the FDA to start inspecting imported olive oil. So, I think which was something that was always under the FDA's purview. So I think if they do more of the things they're already supposed to do, it's going to help American consumers a lot. But in the meantime, we it's not a hopeless situation. In all of these categories, there are real foods, delicious foods, safe foods that we can buy. And that's one of the things I do in the book is at the end of every chapter, the chapter on oil, the chapter on seafood, the chapter on cheese, I give very specific buying tips and information so people can, navigate the landscape as it is right now.
Right, which is why you do books like this, which is why we do shows like this, is to give people more information about it. Can you tell me a little bit about the spices? We see pumpkin spice everything right now. Is the way that the food industry is, well, the way it goes, is pumpkin spice something that's developed by, say, one distributor or several distributors, and then people buy from that distributor, and then it gets put into the various coffees or whatever it is that it's put into? How does it work like that with spices like that?
Well, usually with flavorings, and I think because there's when you say spices, I think people think of like oregano or nutmeg, which are sort of naturally occurring spices, and that industry has its own issues. But with the flavorings issue, is a it's really sort of a laboratory business. They make these chemical flavors. And then they can add them to all kinds of foods, and it's not made by one company. There's lots of companies that make flavorings, but they do provide them to the food service industry. And so just today, I saw at the supermarket, I'd never seen this before. You mentioned pumpkins; it's that fall holiday type. I saw turkey and gravy flavored potato chips.
Right, I've seen those too.
Which I had never seen before. I thought that's kind of novel. But I know, like with Doritos, for example, which, it's the same chip, but it comes in all these different flavors, Cool Ranch, different flavors. It goes down a line and the chips are sprayed with a liquefied version of a flavor. And that's, how a lot of those flavor products work. And I'm very, very wary of the word flavor. That's sort of the code in FDA labeling for not real. So if something is like pumpkin flavored, that's different from it actually containing pumpkin. I talk in my book as a good example about truffle oil. Like truffle oil almost never contains any actual truffle. It's contains what's called natural truffle flavor, which, and natural flavor is a big loophole. That means that the flavor was created through what's considered a natural process. Doesn't mean it was made from a natural ingredient. It's very confusing to consumers, but basically, a lot of the flavored products are distilled. It's the same way you make perfume, and that is considered a natural process because you're basically boiling something and capturing the essence of it. But that doesn't mean that the ingredients you're using are natural. And when you take I went to a flavor lab in London, a business that specialized in creating flavors for the food industry. And to them, the scientist basically told me, if you take any solid substance and you heat it sufficiently, it turns to liquid. Once it turns to liquid, you capture the steam, it recondenses into a clear liquid that is essentially that product in a clear liquid form. And to demonstrate this, he took a beaker and a handful of potting soil, just dirt, put it in this beaker, put it on this super hot burner, heated it until the dirt literally boiled, if you can imagine how hot that would be, recaptured the steam, and handed me a shot glass of this clear liquid that looks like water, and said, "Taste this." And it was essentially liquid dirt. I tasted it. I could not get the taste out of my mouth for like 2 days. But you can do that with anything from, pumpkins to chemicals to grass to dirt. And once you do that, you can add that to any food. You could spray it on, you can add it in. It's not like, they're stirring in, fresh pumpkin in a lot of cases. Sometimes they
Right.
are.
Well, that's what the whole process of natural means. All right, well, we are going to take your calls after we take a quick break here and we come back with Larry Olmsted, and we will take your calls about real food and fake food. This is Lisa Gar, you're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. And Larry Olmsted is my guest from the book Real Food, Fake Food. Let's go to our callers here. We've got a first-time caller, Bob, in Seattle. Hi, Bob. Do you have a question for Larry Olmsted?
Yeah, thanks, Lisa. Larry, I know this isn't actually your slot or
expertise.
whatever you want to call it. But are you or is anybody else tracking the effects of the Fukushima outflow on the Pacific fisheries?
You know, I've seen plenty of literature about it. People are studying it. I haven't seen anything, to be honest, that would prevent me from eating the fish. But I know on you know, the West Coast, it's been more of a matter of concern. And you know, I know it seems like it's been a long time already, but I think the jury's still out.
Okay, thank you.
Well, good question though. And we have, appreciate your call. We have reported on it on this show in the past and just found levels of, there have been studies where levels of radiation poisoning have been found in the foods, but I don't specifically remember. We have done many shows on it, though, here on Coast to Coast. Let's talk to Robert in Chicago. Hi, Robert. Do you have a question for...
Lisa.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Larry. Larry, listen, I'm concerned. I used to be a big fish eater, but not anymore. Because of the worms that have been found in fish, how do these companies keep the worms out or get the worms out of these out of the fish? Like a large company, a big company like McDonald's, you know, they sell that fish sandwich. I'm always concerned about a worm in the fish.
Good point. And beef, too. Beef has worms as well. Maggots.
Well, I mean, with the worms, a lot of it is cut out in the processing. You know, when they cut fish into individual steaks or fillets, they, you know, somebody is physically doing that and looking at the, you know, when you, it's not like most people are buying a whole fish. So when they carve it into fillets, if they see the worms, they throw out that part. McDonald's in particular, it's interesting that you bring that up because, you know, this hasn't gotten a lot of publicity, ironically, because, you know, McDonald's and like Walmart and some other places are under the perception that if they sort of, you know, boast about more sustainable or better ingredients, their customers perceive it as more expensive and don't want to buy it. But a few years ago, McDonald's switched the production or the supply of all of their McFish sandwiches to wild Alaskan pollock. They used to use cod. And the Alaskan pollock fishery is rated one of the most sustainable in the entire world, and it has the certification of the Marine Stewardship Council. You mentioned earlier these third-party seals we can look for at the food. The Marine Stewardship Council seal is considered the best, that the gold standard for the seafood industry for third-party auditing and oversight. And, you know, that's on the McDonald's McFish sandwich, and very few people know that. So it's actually one of the kind of fast foods I feel comfortable eating.
Oh, that's interesting. Wow, great to know. Thank you so much for your call. I remember doing an interview years ago about a guy who took beef, basically, and put it in the freezer and duct taped the freezer, came back, I think, a week or so later, opened it up and found maggots in the beef that laid eggs and had more maggots. And I've seen this several times. You can look it up online. I can't remember the specific guest, but that there are maggots formed in the meat. Is that in the meat before, or is it just frozen and it holds the process of the maggots developing?
No, that's something that comes into the rotting meat, and not just rotting meat, other foods. You know, the maggots, they're, you know, from microscopic, they grow when the food rots. They're not in the food to begin with. They're sort of, for lack of a better word, attracted to the rotting food. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there certainly are issues of worms in, you know, basically all animals. I mean, people can get worms, dogs get worms, but I don't, you know, it's not something that is widespread, especially in the beef industry.
Where are they hanging out? They do attract everything, cat food, dog food. All right, let's go to Spencer in Atlanta. Spencer, do you have a question for Larry Olmsted?
Lisa, I like to say first that George knows how to pick his guest hosts. You have an interviewing style that's so unique and so lovely.
Oh, thank you.
Well, you're welcome. You deserve it.
And
Mr. Olmsted, Well, I asked you about what my question is. We have two parks down here in Atlanta that was designed by Olmsted. Are you some kin to them?
I am. Yeah, that would be Frederick Law Olmsted, who also designed Central Park, most famously in New York, and you know, did a lot of work around the country.
That answers my first question. But now I don't even like salmon.
Yeah, a lot of people don't.
Well, my fish is whiting and perch fillet.
Okay. And
yeah, well, so in general, with seafood, the more expensive the fish, the more fraud there is. So whiting and perch are not as expensive as salmon and red snapper and grouper. So they're generally safer fish to buy. And whiting in particular, if you're buying it, you know, I don't know if you're buying it whole, but, you know, it's a more... I always recommend if people know how to prepare fish, they're better off buying it whole because it's more recognizable.
Wow. So that makes sense. If you have access to the whole fish, you definitely know where it came from and what it looks like. Thank you so much for your call. Appreciate it, Spencer. Have a good night. Let's go to Dean in Tampa, Florida. How's it going there, Dean?
It's going good. I'm just I'm happy that I'm the West Coast instead of the East Coast after Hurricane Matthew.
Wow.
My thoughts and prayers are all to those people. But
I was just going to say the same thing. Absolutely. Yeah. If they can hear us, maybe they'll hear us the next day because a lot of people are don't have power right now. So my thoughts and prayers are with them as well.
Yeah, it's you really know, you know, how you realize what you lose until you lose it, like power, and then, you know, everyone's flocking over to the East Coast because they're looking to you know, our hotel rooms, you know, completely filled up.
Sure.
And I can only imagine what it, you know, what it's like.
You can come to the West Coast. There's not a drop of rain here.
well, that's
sadly,
about, you know. Yeah, that's the one thing. But speaking of fish, ironically, we went through this whole grouper, fake grouper thing here in Tampa with restaurants, and having lived in Alaska, Texas, and Florida for many years and seen, you know, and by the way, I'm not a fan of salmon either. Halibut is much better. But it's really, there's a lot of cases where, you know, we're putting out products that, I mean, even like the tilapia, there was a report that said that, you know, the fish farms, you're not getting the protein, you're not getting the, you know, the nutrients that you would normally get from fish, because we're literally growing them like a factory. And I think that's sad.
That would make sense. The farmed fish don't have the level of nutrients, of course. They're hybridized and chemicalized, and that makes a lot of sense. They would actually have, because of the chemicals, have lower immunity anyway, so they couldn't produce the full amount of, I guess, nutrients in the actual farmed fish. That's a great point.
We're basically getting fake fish.
Mm-hmm.
Which
the farmed fish.
Having, you know, experienced, you know, just fishing in the Keys and fishing in Alaska and parts of Texas, and seeing how, you know, something like that is actually something good for us. But yet, guess what, guys? You know, the chemicals, and you can go to your grocery stores and, you know, and buy your tilapias, which I think we've basically farm that out to the point where there's, you know, there's nothing.
You are correct.
You know, good for us.
Absolutely.
You know, fish is supposed to be good for us.
It's supposed to be. Yeah, it's on the heart healthy diet. Well, thank you so much for your phone call. And Larry, maybe when we come back, we can talk a little bit about fish oils, if you know anything about those, and if those are still good for us based on what we know about farm fish and where those fish oils would be coming from. All right, so we will take a quick break here. We'll be back with Larry Olmsted and you, your phone calls. Thank you so much for calling in. And this is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Garr, and my guest is Larry Olmsted, the author of Real Food, Fake Food, as well as a health journalist, award-winning food journalist and travel writer. Now, we have a caller on the line, Carrie, who's calling in from Alaska. Apparently, he is an Alaskan fisherman. Hi, Carrie. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how are you doing, Lisa?
Great, great. Thanks for your phone call. What is your question, Carrie?
Well, I'm a commercial fisherman and been in the salmon industry for over 20 years in Alaska, about 25 years.
Wow.
And I think Larry would be an awesome guy to advertise our fish because he's been saying a lot of great things. I don't know if you realize this, but we have outlawed all farm fishing in Alaska.
Really?
So, yeah, and we have done a great job, or I should say we, the regulators have done a great job of keeping the fishery sustainable, and it really helps out. But we've actually caught Atlantic farm fish in Alaska, so what he mentioned earlier about the contamination is a big concern for us.
So you've already found, would you say that those are genetically modified farm fish?
Well, they're basically farm fish. You know, they're raised in their own coop, and they get all kinds of diseases. And the biggest concern is when they, you know, have a fence that breaks and they escape, we're worried that the diseases that they carry could transfer over to the wild salmon. That's the biggest concern we have.
How can you tell the difference? What do they look like?
Well, Atlantic salmon do look a lot different. And so the fish and game has given us, for just any normal person would be a little tough, but we're used to catching all the different species. We have sockeyes and kings and chums and different species. So they do look different, and there's certain, fin characteristics that we have to look at, and that's how we can tell the difference. But it is a big concern. One other thing I wanted to bring up real quick, if you don't mind, I was born and raised in Japan and as a missionary kid, so I speak fluent Japanese. So he was mentioning sushi, and I eat sushi a lot here in the U.S. But what a lot of people don't realize is probably 90-some% of all sushi restaurants are not Japanese. Did you know that?
Right, and the sushi in Japan is so different than the sushi here.
Yeah. Oh yes,
you cannot. It's not even this recognizable.
Right, and so keeping the legitimate salmon in that sushi is really difficult for the consumer to ever know whether it's really Alaska salmon or farm salmon or even like he was talking about tilapia and things like that.
How would you tell the difference?
I really appreciate the service that Larry's offered. Thanks, Larry. You're great. You're a great source of information for everybody.
Thank you so much for your question. Let me ask you real quick, Carrie. If you were to just give us a few pointers, how could we tell the difference between farmed salmon and fresh Atlantic salmon?
Well, I'll be real perfectly honest with you. Even though I've been in the industry, both as a fisherman and a buyer and a tenderman and a processor for years and years and years, it's hard for me to tell the difference.
Wow.
Yeah.
Alaskan salmon, sorry.
But the difference actually exists more in the, you know, we're worried about the chemicals, the way they're brought up, and the safety aspect. So just the flavor, you know, I can tell most of the time, but it's difficult just by looking. It's more in the quality of the fish. And like a sushi chef, they know the difference because they're buying it. So it's the integrity of the store that you really almost have to rely on.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much for your insight. I appreciate it. Larry, do you have any comments about that? Anything to contribute?
Because I mean, Terry brought up a great point, which is that aquaculture is illegal in Alaska. So it's not just the salmon; it's any seafood you buy from Alaska. You know, they're famous for their crabs, but there's also a lot of pollock, halibut. These are all wild caught fish, and which to me is a good thing. In Alaska, they have a logo for their seafood. It says Alaska Fresh Wild, and they spend a lot of money protecting that logo. If people rip it off, they'll sue them. So I look at that as something really good. If you see a can of salmon and it has that Alaska logo, that's a good sign. You know, the sushi issue, you know, sushi began as sort of a celebratory fine dining kind of thing. You know, you would go to a sushi restaurant for a nice meal, and there would be a chef behind the counter, and he would take a big piece of salmon or tuna or whatever the fish was and cut it in front of you to order to make your dinner. And now we've kind of dumbed down sushi to the point where people think it's something you pick up in a plastic box at the supermarket. You know, most of the people who eat sushi in this country are never seeing it made, and I think that's a big part of the problem.
Right. We don't even see it at the bar any longer, the sushi bar. We sit at the table. All right, we need to take another quick break, and I think the answer here is to be vegan. That would probably help. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the important stuff like champagne, whiskey, and coffee. We will be right back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. So Larry Olmsted is my guest, and we're talking about real food versus fake food. Now, here I am sitting here with some Halloween candy because it is the season. And on my candy bar here, it says, here's the milk chocolate. And the ingredients are sugar, chocolate, cocoa butter, skim milk, lactose, and milk fat. So where's the chocolate tree? I want to know that. Can I just...
chocolate, like coffee, you know, grows in warm weather climates.
But why doesn't it say cacao instead of... I mean, there is no such thing as chocolate trees.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So funny that they would put chocolate as the ingredients.
Yeah, usually it would say, cocoa.
What? But it says milk chocolate ingredients, sugar, chocolate. And this is like your Hershey's and your M&M's. I mean, but maybe I'm missing something. But I'm just wondering if you're looking at something about like champagne. Here's a perfect example. If you can explain a little bit about the Champagne region and the process that champagne is made is specific to the region of Champagne, France, right?
Well, it should be.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, Champagne obviously is named for the Champagne region where it was invented. It's the world's most famous wine. And, you know, what obviously sets it apart is the fact that it's sparkling and it has the bubbles. And the way that... that is produced is by adding a little bit of yeast and a little bit of sugar, and as the sugar eats the yeast, it converts it to gas, which is what the bubbles are. And by law, that has to be done in the individual bottle. So if you visit the Champagne region, there's these cellars, and there's thousands and thousands, well, millions of bottles in racks going through this process. And each bottle is sort of, you know, its own little science experiment. It's like a little winery in each bottle. And it's a very expensive way to produce wine because then each bottle has to be opened and recorked and turned. But the result tastes really good. And they also use, there's a lot of quality control standards. They use excellent grapes. There's, you know, a reason why champagne is famously good. But you can also make sparkling wine in a lot of other ways. You can do the same process in big tanks, or you can skip the fermentation part altogether and just take still wine and inject gas into it like Coca-Cola's made, just carbonate wine, basically. And any of those methods are legal to produce bottles in the United States that can be labeled champagne. And that surprises a lot of consumers when they survey consumers. People almost always infallibly believe that the word champagne means it has to come from Champagne. And in most of the world, that's true, but not in the United States. And it's similar to, we talked about earlier, Kobe beef. It's These are, and Parmesan cheese, these are foods that are known as geographically indicated foods. They're associated with a place. And for the most part in the U.S., those foods are not protected by law. So you can, you know, take these famous names that have a high designation of quality and make them very inexpensively and sell them, and consumers are confused.
Does that same thing go for scotch and whiskey?
No, so scotch I use in my book as an example of sort of how the right way to regulate this industry is. And, you know, for reasons that are really unclear, Congress, literally, you know, we say, oh, we need an act of Congress. There's an act of Congress in the Federal Register to protect scotch specifically that says, you know, scotch whiskey can only be a product of Scotland made under the laws of the English government, the British government, and it's really one of the only foods that gets that. So we don't have that for champagne or Kobe beef or Parmesan cheese. You know, so when you buy scotch whiskey, you know exactly what you're getting in terms of quality and origin. And to me, that's the way all of our food should be.
Fascinating. Do you think that, I mean, that was obviously grandfathered in from other countries from a very long time ago. Do you think that the FDA is part of some type of a maybe big conspiracy to decimate the food industry and basically make us all sick? I remember, you know, getting on a flight. We were in Italy. We came back to the U.S. and I got onto one of the airport buses and all I saw was edema and hair falling out. And I really looked at the American people, and it sometimes looks like it's a conspiracy. It really does. What is your thought about that?
No, I don't. I can't really, you know, buy into that. I think, you know, certainly, we have one of the best healthcare systems in the world. You know, we pioneer all kinds of cutting edge medicine here, a lot of which is also, you know, under the auspices of the FDA. And in certain areas of food, you know, we talked like a lot tonight about aquaculture. The U.S. has by far the best both aquaculture and wild fishery management in the world. The problem is we don't do a lot of aquaculture in this country because it's too expensive to do it the way that we mandate because of the quality. So most is imported. But I think if there was a food conspiracy against the American people, then we would have much more lax laws when it comes to things like grading beef and producing fish. So no, I think it's more just a lot of poorly used resources.
Well, all right. So, I mean, there are a lot of solutions here, and there are great, I mean, in terms of a website, can you suggest a website that does recommend some of the more trusted brands that you recommend in the book? Do you put them all in one place anywhere?
Well, I mean, the website for my book is the same title. Real, you know, the book is Real Food, Fake Food. The website is realfoodfakefood.com, and I have links to a lot of articles from, you know, very legitimate news sources like 60 Minutes, and you know, different exposés on the various foods. But it really varies by the type of food. So, you know, like I get there's a great resource. Website for olive oil that's very up to date that I give, you know, in the book, and it's also on my website, you know, but there's no one sort of clearinghouse for all the different foods. It depends on the category.
Okay. I want to take one more call here. We've got Brenda calling in from Morgantown, West Virginia. Brenda, hi, do you have a question for or a comment?
Hi, Larry. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Yeah, you guys are on a topic that has been a big part of my life. Well, I'm 58 years old now, and when I was 24, I'd bought my first piece of property and designed and built my first house.
Mm.
Well,
wow.
For 25 years, I've been drinking distilled water because I have stomach problems. But also, almost all my life, you guys, I've been eating organic food that I grew myself out of my own garden.
Uh-huh.
And I just think that people still don't understand, you know, that they need to get back to basics. And you can read and study and everything you want, but it's still, you got to grow your own stuff in your own dirt if you don't want what to care what you eat, you know?
If you want to control it.
Yeah,
can I ask you a question?
Free-range chickens. I live in an area where people have chickens and everything. Free-range chickens, the eggs are taste so different, it's unreal, if they really are free range and they do actually get out in the yards and in the fields and eat, you know, the bugs and everything they're supposed to eat, you know. And the HMO stuff, oh my God, it's getting to the point where without the right seeds, I can't even grow a garden anymore. And everybody I know that's vegan is a lot healthier than me. And I've been trying, like 80% of my life has been vegan. And I've probably been dead now if it wasn't for the way I ate because of all the family medical history I inherited.
Mm.
But anyway, it's been a big, my life has been a big experiment on all this. And I would just like to say, I just wish people would really get, you know, in reality, their brain in reality here and start understanding that growing their own stuff is the only way they're going to know.
Do you grow anything hydroponically?
I had a friend, let me say one more thing. I had this friend come from New York City to my farm and he stayed a few months. I could not keep this man out of my garden. He ate food out of my garden though, Lisa. He said, oh my God, I can't believe what this tastes like. And I said, yeah, that's right, Rob. This is real food. You've been eating in New York City all your life. I said, hey, after that was it. I couldn't keep that man out of the garden. He couldn't believe the difference.
Did he move back? Yeah, I know. It's once you eat like that. We've gotten so far away from the garden and so into our markets and restaurants. It is a different way of life. And we have to keep doing shows like this and reading books like this and having people like you on to remind us we need to eat back from the ground and from the earth. Thank you so much for your call, Brenda. I appreciate it. Yeah, I definitely do see a rise in autoimmune disease. And if we have as many toxins as we do in our air and our soil and our water, that's obviously going into our food. So we need to do other things in order to combat this, especially with this huge rise in autoimmune diseases these days. And it's just not slowing down. Do you have any comment on that in terms of the relationship between what you talk about with fake food and disease?
Well, I mean, the CDC documents something like 40-something million cases of food-related illness a year in the United States, and the vast majority, something like 80% of those, they don't know the cause of. You know, so there's definitely, I think, and there's a big correlation between what we eat and our health. And, you know, I approach this book, as a food writer, predominantly so my interest is in a lot of ways based on taste. You know, I want to eat things that taste delicious. And our gut reaction, I think, is that things that taste good aren't always so good for you because people like things like chocolate bars. But the reality I found is that, you know, when you eat these real foods like real extra virgin olive oil that's, you know, fresh squeezed from olives and real wild-caught fish, and they're almost always healthier and they almost always taste better. It's sort of a win-win once you start eating real food. Mm-hmm. You know, that tomato from your garden is always going to taste better than the one from the supermarket.
Absolutely, and so is the real olive oil and so forth. Well, thank you so much for the information, Larry. I appreciate you staying up for this conversation tonight. It's been fascinating and listeners loved it, and I appreciate you being on.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. All right, and we will be back. We're going to be talking with U.S. Navy Commanding Officer and the aide to the Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, Suzanne Giesman. She's going to be joining us next to talk about her book called Messages of Hope. This is Lisa Garr, and you're listening to Coast to Coast AM.